Welcome to the podcast series from the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration 2023, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You're listening to the lecture entitled Passports, Visas, Coats of Arms of a Feudalistic Mindset by Boldizsár Nagy. Boldizsár is Associate Professor at the Central European University in Austria, where he teaches refugee and international law. He's also one of the founders of the European Society of International Law and of the Refugee Law Reader. Additionally, he is a member of the editorial boards of the International Journal of Refugee Law and the European Journal of Migration and Law. Most of his research centers on refugee and migration law, but he has also published on a wide variety of other international law subjects, including sovereignty, the common heritage of mankind, and nationality. Enjoy the lecture!
When I sent my slides to Sona, she said, oh, they are somewhat provocative, and they are not, but they will pull you out of your comfort zone. They will share with you views which are counterintuitive. Anyone who works in migration or works as a border guard or works in that field will resist them. And that's why I'm happy that you came closer, because I invite you to stop me, to contradict, to challenge. There will be lots of things which I say which you won't buy at first sight. Now, the hope is that later on, maybe in 40 minutes, you might change your views and your mind. In order to do that, why don't we now turn to a Slido question?
The following question was presented to the audience through Slido. Would it be morally fair to deny Schengen tourist visas to Russian citizens because Russia invaded Ukraine? You can choose yes, no, I'm hesitant.
Thank you so much. As you see, there is no natural answer to this question. Many of you, as you saw, believe it would be unfair to deny. Others thought it would be fair. That's the same within the EU. Some EU prime ministers believed it would be fair to deny them entry visa as tourists, and others believed that it would be very, very unfair. There was a huge debate in the scholarship whether it can be done or not. That's why I asked the moral aspect, not the legal aspect, because it's very much debated whether it's compatible with the Schengen Border Code and the visa regime. So let's go into the answers on that question. I mean, those who favor a ban, that's the second column, they say if visas are vis-a-vis a third country, if they may depend on a country's action, moving to from visa-free access to the visa-obliged access and back and forth, then a total ban is also conceivable. So if we can put a country on the visa-obliged list, then we can also put that country to the total visa ban list. And if that's now illegal, we can change the laws to make it legal. I mean, there's nothing against that. And anyhow, economic sanctions do hit the whole population, so why pretend that a visa ban is worse than the economic sanctions? Those who believe that the ban should not be introduced, they basically say that it's illegal at the moment, according to the law, that it's morally wrong. And that's one of my main ideas here during the whole talk. Are we in favor of collective punishment? Do we believe that people should suffer for the deeds of their government, whether democratically elected or not? Obviously, it's inhuman towards those who want to escape, like people who want to avoid drafting into the Russian army. And one might also mention that we don't remember any case in which the US would be put under a visa ban because they invaded another country. Now, a technicality concerning my following slides. There is much more on the slides than what I can explain in these 40 minutes. So don't be frustrated. First of all, the slides are already uploaded to my website. And my website is my name in the Hungarian order, which is contrary to all the Western European orders. It's nagyboldizsár.hu. You find the slides. The slides contain all that material, and the notes pages contain even more material in order to be studied at home or recalled. Here now, just look into my eyes and listen to whatever I say and contradict, challenge, deny what I say. All right? So that's how we move on. That's also, Sona would say, provocative, I believe, because here the question is, that's the second introductory question. During the GlobSec and before, a few days before and after, this very country introduced border controls, informed the Schengen Secretariat that Slovakia will apply border controls, relying partly on GlobSec and partly on the Hell's Angels Slovakia event. But that controls were only extended to the road traffic. Now, is there any one of you who believes that if a terrorist really wanted to attack Ursula von der Leyen at the GlobSec, that person would be come in a car and the border controls would stop that car and pick that person saying, oh, I know that you are going to commit a terrorist attack against GlobSec, so now we catch you. Does any one of you ever believe that? That these controls ever will catch a serious terrorist? Do you think that the serious terrorist would not read the announcement of Slovakia 3 months before saying that on the roads I will introduce control? And would that terrorist not take an airplane or a train? The other one in red is the French one. They are notorious. They are extending internal border controls. Now, in May, they already knew that the Rugby World Cup in October is such a dangerous event that they have to maintain border controls at the French borders. What I want to say with that is that these arguments are absurd. Most of them are absurd, sometimes not. GlobSec, as a matter of fact, was really a high-profile event. So increased security was fully justified. But whether being entitled to control the roads is enough to prevent anything from happening, that I challenge, but you are the experts. Tell me I'm wrong. And now we get to the essential topic of today, passports and visas. And in terms of, if you want the theory or more abstract foundation, one can argue that the passports as such have a dual character. On the one hand, they are certainly feudalistic. That is, they express a bond, an allegiance between the sovereign, the prince, whoever, and the individual. The sovereign, the prince, promises to protect the individual while traveling abroad and asks other sovereigns to take good care of his or her subject and not inhibit his or her movement. That's the original meaning of passports, and on the next page you will see a reference to that in the real text. But in reality, passports may have come to widespread acceptance at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. John Torpy has written a book which is quoted everywhere. You will find it in the bibliography, where he basically argues that this was needed for governmentality, that the states wanted to know who is on their territory, wanted to make people have documents, individual documents like ID cards or something like that. And so it was needed for the modern nation state, if it existed, to be able to differentiate between us and them, the alien and the national. Guy Goodwin-Gill, who has heard the name of Guy Goodwin-Gill before? Hands up. Guy Goodwin-Gill. Not yet? Now, he's a living semi-god in refugee law. Really, there are two of them. Who knows who the other one is? Who's the other semi-god in refugee law? One is Guy Goodwin-Gill. The other one? Nobody's working with refugees? Okay, the other one is James Hathaway. Both of them come from Canada. So Guy Goodwin-Gill didn't start out as a refugee lawyer. He started out as a migration lawyer. And as you see on the slide, in 1978, he published a monograph on the right of movement. And there he wrote that very little consensus as to the role which passports are intended to play can be found. So people disagree on what passports do. And he differentiates between interstate functions and domestic functions and says, on the one hand, it testifies to nationality and identity. On the other, it is a tool to be entitled to request consular and diplomatic protection. And note that it's 78. He notes that passports are good because we can return persons to the country which issued the passport. If you want, fight against illegal migration, as many of your colleagues would say. And then there's a long quote from an American publication of 1942, which basically says that passport expresses allegiance. Still, just like in the 19th century or earlier, the idea is that the passport holder should be faithful and obedient to the sovereign which issued the passport. For example, he shouldn't enter the service of any other state or an international organization, if you want. But that's the international function. What is the domestic function? You see two questions there. Is a passport prerequisite to travel abroad? Is it good if it is? Should it be? And is there a right to get that passport if that is needed to travel abroad? Now, I look around in the audience, and very few of you may have a memory, but your parents or grandparents may have a memory of the times when departing from Slovakia was pretty complicated because you have to apply for an exit passport, and you either got it or not. And there are still many countries, especially if you are an opposition figure, let's say in Iran or Russia, you simply don't get a passport. So the question is, do we have a right to have our passports? And that was even debated in the United States of America, because passports were not, as I said, not generally required before the First World War, but thereafter, yes, it became the time when it was required. Now, during the Cold War period, a duality prevailed, because on the one hand, the West was very intensively promoting emigration, the right to emigrate, that is, to have passport or to be entitled to leave without a passport. That was an ideological struggle with the communist East. But on the other hand, even the U.S. was using the issuance of passports as a political tool. And in the notes pages, you will see references to the cases through which the doctrine developed that the U.S. cannot deny passport even if the person is a suspected communist, which they invariably did. They simply didn't give a passport to someone of whom they thought he was a communist or she was a communist. Now, the courts had to rectify it. But still, what remained, and that's what you see here, is that territorial limitations of passports prevail even now. So certain U.S. citizens, as other citizens as well, do have a passport, but they're not allowed to travel to any country. I mean, notoriously, the Americans couldn't travel to Cuba for decades, for example. Their passport was not valid for Cuba. Now, the passport as a tool of immigration control, which we have started to discuss, that can be put into the context of the ICCPR Article 12, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. Now, what does it say? It on the one hand says everyone lawfully within the territory may move within the territory, but then paragraph 2 says everyone shall be free to leave any country, including, but not limited, obviously, his own. Now, who of you have heard about the Libyan border guards retaining the persons who are trying to get to Italy? I don't deny that states do have a right to retain certain persons. But that, and that's what you see on the left-hand side, must have a very good cause, like a pending criminal case. A criminal should not be allowed to go abroad while the case hasn't been cleared. Or family reasons or minor children should be prevented from emigrating on their own. But that should be done in a due process. So explaining why the person can't leave, the person having a right to legal remedy, challenging the prohibition of departing. And it must not be discriminatory. So it mustn't be that the communists don't get the passport and the true believers do get the passport. There must be an individualized reason for that, not a prejudicial group reason. And still, any time we don't issue a passport to a certain person, that's a limitation on liberty. It's not a deprivation of liberty, but it's a limitation of liberty. And again, a central idea of this talk is that I'm against any limitation of liberty unless it is fully justified based on reasons all the affected persons accept. Okay, not just the national security officers. The passport is a kind of a stigma. The nationality is a kind of a stigma if you are born to the wrong place. And this is a table, again, don't try to read it in detail, there's no purpose in that. It's a comprehensive table of Trump's travel bans. Now, he introduced travel bans against certain countries, then he changed it, then he changed it, then he changed it. In a matter of 3 years, the countries changed a lot, except for five, like Iran or Somalia or Syria. Even Sudan was on the list and then off the list. So one can argue, is it well-founded if you change it every year? I think these two slides, the Trump ban and the Biden reaction to that, are enough to convince you that there's no such thing as national interest. There isn't such. Trump was arguing that his ban is in the national interest. Biden said this is a stain on our conscience, that it was totally against the U.S. interest. So then, is there such thing as a U.S. interest? No, there isn't. There are politically prevailing forces which pretend that they can create the interest, but it's an interpretative exercise. Now, the Russians are not only threatened with not getting visas, but it is an adopted measure of the European Union, our countries, not to recognize certain passports. So there is a decision of the Parliament and the Council in which they decided that passports issued in certain territories or to inhabitants of certain territories won't be recognized for visa purposes. The people in Donetsk and Luhansk and Crimea won't get an EU visa, a Schengen visa, if they have a passport issued by the Russian authorities, except for minors, except for incapacitated persons, and it does not prevent asylum seekers from seeking asylum. Now, what is the essence of this passport case this time? The essence is that as long as you have individual sanctions against politicians, economic leaders, military leaders, whoever, of Russia, that's based on individual responsibility contributing to Putin's regime. And that's easy to accept. But as soon as you have a blanket non-recognition of passports, you make that population a tool in the, if you want, interstate debate between Russia and the member states of the EU, which is more questionable. Now, what is then a passport, you might ask? And what is the difference between a passport and a travel document? Does anyone know? Is there anyone who would say, oh, I know exactly what is the difference between a travel document and a passport? Nobody deals in passports? Okay, then it's not superfluous. To tell you, these are IOM definitions. On the left-hand side, you see the passport definition. The essential difference is that it includes the right to return. Remember Guy Goodwin Gill. We need the passports to know where to send the people back. A travel document may not include the right to return. It shows the identity, testifies for the identity, but it may not guarantee a return. Now, you won't only love it because it is colorful. You will love it because it shows that we can't know. There's no way of knowing. This is one page of an Excel table which has more than 2,000 rows. Listing all the countries, and on the horizontal axis, in the lilac, you see all the EU countries, and telling which passports is recognized by which EU country. So that's the Argentine case, and if you go there, you have the ordinary passport or diplomatic passport. These are all different passports and travel document types of Argentine, and these are the EU states, starting with the Benelux and ending with Switzerland, which is associated. And then you see that some of them are fully accepted, the green ones, and some of them are not, or they are accepted with certain remarks. So the poor border guard, who is to check the person coming with an Argentinian travel document, is supposed to know all that by heart and for another 160 countries. Okay. The power of passport. This is the section within VR, and you will see that similar slide later on today. There are different indexes, and they measure somewhat differently. But the essence is, to how many countries can you enter without a visa or getting an entry visa or other permit at the border? And at the Orton index, it is the United Arab Emirates, which is on top, and then comes Sweden and Germany. But obviously there are tremendous differences. So if you go to the bottom, you have Iraq, where the Iraqi nationals can enter 9 countries without a visa and 34 getting an entry permit at the border. Syria and Afghanistan is at the very bottom. That's what I mean. You are born to a country and it is like a feudal privilege or disprivilege. You are born to the right place, you are an aristocrat. You are a ruler. You are born to the bad place, you are a serf. You are born a serf, you remain a serf. There's no way out. As long as you have an Afghanistani passport, you have an Afghanistani passport. And it's very difficult to buy a St. Kitts and Nevis passport instead. Okay? So, obviously, the problem behind is nationality. That we are bound to our nationality, we can't change it. We are born into something of which for which we are not responsible. Nevertheless, it determines our life chances to a large extent. That was about passports. Now let's move on to visas. And I believe that the visas are stigmatization. Okay, stigmas. Identifying the bad ones in this sense. Stigma has meant several meanings, but here, pointing to someone who is guilty or something like that. And there's a dual stigmatization in the visa regime. On the one hand, you put a country on the visa list. You stigmatize the whole country. You say, oh, you are dangerous. Oh, there are many illegal migrants coming from your country. All of you should apply for a visa. And then the second stigmatization relates to the individual. Oh, you come from a visa-obliged country, but you never get a visa because you are a threat to us. We know you are bad. You will behave badly. You will overstay. So, now let's look into that a bit more seriously. Again, what I argue is that denying a visa is denying a freedom of movement. That is limiting individual liberties. And as you might know, in human rights law, limiting or deprivation of liberty may serve as a punishment, or exceptionally, there might be other compelling reasons like a pandemic. So COVID-19, okay, that's justified, or a local pandemic. But otherwise, no. Now then, let me ask you, who of you has read the EU visa regulation? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay. Here you see there was the old one and the new one. I mean, the visa list regulation, I should have said. Ask yourself, what does it depend on whether Ecuador is on the list or is not on the list? Have you ever asked yourself, what does it depend on? Whether Moldova is on the list or is not on the list, or Montenegro, and so on. Now, if you look at the visa regulation, the visa list regulation, you see the argumentation. It was not exactly the first one, but almost, let's put it that way, as if it was. Because that was the first harmonized visa regulation, the 2001. It says, illegal immigration, public policy and security, and the union's external relations. These three factors influence if a state ends up on the visa list or not. That's stigma one. The new one, which was adopted in 2018, essentially retains that structure, but adds economic benefits, refers to the relevant third countries, and to the situation of human rights. As to the persons, who of those who are visa-obliged should be denied a visa, the regulation says, particular consideration shall be given to the applicant's present risk of illegal immigration, a risk to the security of the member states, all of them, not just the one into which he or she wants to travel. And if the applicant intends to leave the territory within the visa time or not. Now, we are coming to the end of the talk, slowly. What's the problem with that? Look at the illegal migration argument. This is the logic behind risk of illegal migration, immigration. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Or if you want, it's a vicious circle. You deny a lot of visa applications. Then you say, oh, I have denied a lot of applications. There is a danger of illegal immigration. So I have to deny a lot of applications. It's a vicious circle. There is an illegal danger of illegal immigration because I denied a lot of visas, I have to deny a lot of visas because there is a danger of illegal immigration. If you let in everyone, there would be no danger of illegal immigration, probably. But the major moral problem is the second one. Why can't the Indians come and work in Slovakia or stay in Slovakia, not work yet, stay in Slovakia without a visa? Because there might have been a few thousands which overstayed in the U.S. And therefore, 1.5 billion people are stigmatized and obliged to take up a visa. Pay 80 euros, travel God knows how far to get to an EU representation. Apply personally, collect all the documents. Why? Because a few, maybe tens of thousands, committed something out of 1.5 billion. Okay? So basically, it's collective punishment. Some of your folks committed irregular deeds, not crimes. These are minor administrative offenses, okay? And therefore, you all suffer. Third, the data on illegal migration, as they like to call it, are notoriously unreliable. By definition, there is no statistics on it. There are guessworks, more or less informed guessworks, of how many persons are staying without a permit in a country, or how many persons are employed without the due process and the labor permits. My friends in the asylum field, I mean, they would shout all the time saying that visas effectively prevent people from coming, that is, people in need of international protection. If I wanted to be rude and short, I would say, we kill all those who drown at the Mediterranean Sea. If we gave a visa, 80 euros, they took a budget flight, another 80 euros, for 160 euros, they could be here. Instead, they pay 3 to 5,000 euros to the smuggler, and they die. Significant numbers die. Thousands die every year. The total number, depending on how you calculate, is anything between 20,000 and 40,000. We kill them, in effect. Now, a more subtle thing, of which you hear perhaps less, is the machine bias. Who of you has heard about machine bias? Artificial intelligence, great data. So the problem is, and the most frightening, you will find again a quote here at the bottom from Stefan Mao. Imagine that the Americans are contemplating to review your Twitter, Facebook, and other accounts to figure out if you are reliable. And that's happening. That they do the data mining and they harvest anything which relates to you. And it's easy, and enormous amount of information can be collected on you online. Now, the machine will have certain biases, therefore, because it will presume that certain groups of people are more prone to, let's say, illegal immigration, overstaying, in other words, okay? And it's very difficult to rectify, because the officer to whom the appeal goes, because at the moment, for example, the EU wants to have a human appeal against a machine decision, preliminary machine decision, the officer will believe, oh, the machine is not a human. It's unbiased. It's objective. If the machine says so, it must be so. And that's patently wrong. Okay? Now, that's another statement which I expect you to challenge, and that's what I raised with Globsec as well. That I went through the Schengen visa questionnaire as when preparing for this talk, and I found not a single question which would reveal any of the dangers, whether national security or overstaying, in the visa questionnaire. Nobody of you works in visa offices, consulates. Have you worked in a consulate? You have. I mean, do you think that any questionnaire will reveal a genuine terrorist? You can identify the potential prostitute, perhaps, but even that is very biased. No, that's one of the major functions. You are in the consular post in Moldova, you want to screen out the potential prostitutes. You are in Turkey, you want to screen out the small dealers. But the questionnaires essentially aren't good for that. Then, 7, if you look at the EU visa list, there are two African countries which are not on the list, the Seychelles and Mauritius. All others are on it. So the assumption is that this is racism without race. It's not racially justified. But basically, there is a presumption that the Africans are not good. They will overstay, they will misbehave, God knows what. Let's put them on the visa list. And then let's not give them visas, obviously. The 8th, then the last argument here, is also very painful. And we are coming to the last slide then, next to last. And that is that if any of the EU member states has a problem with a third state and wants that third state on the visa list, because indeed too many people come from Albania, okay, and overstay and illegally work, then that state can put that third state on the visa list with a little bit of political effort. And then the citizens of that third state are excluded from 26 other states as well, which other states otherwise had no problem with the given country. It was only one. And that can make 26 other countries unreachable. Okay, now can we go back to our last Slido?
The following question was presented to the audience through Slido. Having heard this, meaning the lecture, my view on the denial of visa to Russians in light of the aggression is, I still believe blanket denial is fair. I changed my view from considering denial unfair to consider it fair. I changed my view from denial being fair to unfair. I still believe that blanket denial is unfair. I still do not know.
So there is some movement within you. At least some of you became less hesitant than in the beginning you were. Wonderful. So what about the feudal mindset? In short, must Harry the Prince give his fingerprints when he applies for a visa? And the answer is no. On the right-hand side you see, the following applicants shall be exempt from the requirements to give fingerprints: heads of states or governments and their spouses, and members of the official delegation, the court, the king and the court, and sovereigns and the senior members of the royal family. Really the court. Okay. Now, of course, with Harry, there is some problem. Is he still a senior member of the royal family? Or is he no longer? That I leave to the border guards among you. And so, coming to the serious part, this is the serious part, sort of recapitulating what we have said, that passports and nationality determine your life chances, like birth in feudalism. If born a serf, then dying as a serf, bound to the birth, the land of the birth. If born as a citizen with a powerless passport, you're stuck with that. You're with that till the end of your life. A denial of passport, not giving a passport to a national, is a denial of the right of exit. It's a limitation of liberty. And the territorial power, the prince, so to say, has control over the exit of the subjects. Nothing has changed. Okay, it's like in feudalism. The visa is a collective stigma. It's a punishment of the transgression of others or the consequence of the bad relations between states. So either it's the illegal immigration danger or the national security danger or the interstate relations danger. Denial of visa is a denial of entry. It's a limitation of liberty. And it entails occasionally pushback, people who nevertheless want to come, and they are pushed back to the sea, and many of them die on the sea. And believe it or not, the visa code very clearly says that even if you have a visa, there's no guarantee that we let you in. So the total discretionary power of the prince is still with us. If I'm in bad mood, you are not in. If I'm in good mood, you are in. No guarantee. You did all the work, getting a visa, traveling, flying to my country, and at the border I can turn you away if I want. And the arcane nature of the thing is by the British passports. You know how many types of British passports exist? 6 types. But only one of them entitles you to live in Britain. But the others are also British nationals. So that's, again, this kind of arcane feudalistic structure. And the last slide, what is then the solution? That's nothing new to the audience who was here a few years ago. Ladies and gentlemen, I seriously believe that within the present frame of interpretation, borders, territoriality, visas, passports, nationality, there is no balance, chance for a balance. There's no chance for a settled existence. It's only if we return to the 19th century or if we return to the rules before Schengen in the EU. So I'm not preaching the abolition of borders and border controls. I have no great problems with that. But I think that everybody should be entitled to move wherever they want to and given a chance to try to start their life. They would not be entitled to social services. Social services would be attached to the length of the stay and the embeddedness in the society. So you would not have claims, but you would have the liberty to come and find a job. Just like it happened with the temporary protected Ukrainians. They could go wherever they wanted, and 4 million somehow found their place. We are up and down if 500,000 or 800,000 asylum seekers come and we say, oh, the boat is full, blah, blah, blah. When 4 million Ukrainians come and we let them go where they want to, then the things sort out themselves. I don't say we are not doing a lot for them. We are. Some countries especially are. They need assistance. They need care. I'm not saying it's not a task for these societies, but these societies can manage it. Wir schaffen es, as it used to be said. So it was provocative. I hope it brought you out of your comfort zone.
This lecture was part of the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.